From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. On this day in 1861, the Georgia Secession Convention opened in Milledgeville. A few days later, state leaders there voted to secede from the Union. Today we're learning about a largely unexplored facet of what followed. While the Civil War calls to mind the epic clash between Union and Confederate soldiers, off the battlefield, the war for food, timber, shelter, and control was waged largely on civilians. Historian and Atlanta native Dr. Joan Cashin details the toll in a new book called War Stuff: The Struggle for Human and Environmental Resources in the American Civil War. Dr. Cashin, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You studied dozens of archives, newspapers, military records, personal letters to get this picture of life in the South before secession. I know it's a big swath, but how would you characterize their material and communal lives?
Sure. Well, it's very clear from the records that white Southerners value material resources. They see them as things that are precious, that have to be preserved, that have to be handled carefully in order for human beings to survive and in order for communities to survive and flourish. So if we look at food, they see food as a precious resource that should not be wasted. They feel the same way about timber, since wood can be put to so many different uses on the average farm. And they feel the same way about the built environment, especially the private home. You know, that these are resources that people have to be careful with, and that the community and the family and the individual all have obligations to take care of these resources. And they also have obligations to each other, you know, as people. There's a strong sense of community that prevails in the rural and small town South.
Well, then came secession, opening the floodgates for war and armies trouncing across the North and the South. How was the experience different for rural people in the North and the South?
Well, the North is largely spared the juggernaut of war. There are only two serious attempts to invade the North, Robert E. Lee in Maryland in 1862 and Lee again in 1863. And both times he gets stopped at different battles, Antietam in Maryland and Gettysburg in Pennsylvania, and he has to turn around and go back. So the burden of war falls almost exclusively on white Southerners. That's where the major fighting takes place. And that's the major focus of my book.
And armies, they need provisions, food, medicine, shelter. We have this image of white Southerners in popular culture, especially in the Lost Cause revision of history, that they supported the Confederate Army full stop and all the soldiers. Is that accurate?
No, that is not accurate. And I'm glad you brought that up. That's a fantasy that's really created after the war, the notion that all white Southerners united during the war to fight for the Confederacy. In fact, a significant minority in the population was pro-Union. About 40% of the electorate in 1860 voted against secession. And when the war broke out, approximately 100,000 white men from the Confederate states served in the Union Army. You know, that's a lot of people. More people serve in the Confederate Army, obviously. The usual estimate is about 750,000. But still, if you have 100,000 white men who feel strongly enough about it to serve in the Federal Army, that suggests a deep a hostility towards the Confederacy. And what happens during the war is the two armies are acutely aware of the division inside the white Southern population. They know that from the beginning. They know that some civilians are pro-Union and some civilians are pro-Confederate. And at the beginning of the war, many white civilians are eager to help the army that they support. So pro-Confederate civilians are glad to share food with a company passing through their neighborhood. And pro-Union civilians do the same thing, obviously, for the Northern Army. But then as the war unfolds and the armies need more and more resources and often will simply take what they need from civilians, white civilians begin to pull back. You know, they begin to realize that their own survival might be at stake. And they think that that is important. You know, they think that, their own survival is at least as important as any military objective. So you see this all over the region, and soldiers themselves comment on it. A Confederate soldier wrote in the last winter of the war in 1864-65, he said that white people shrink and hide from us. You know, they run away and hide when they see a Confederate army coming close.
Yeah, and we're not just talking about, you know, Sherman's devastating march at the end of the war. As you said, this happened all over. And there's a story in the book. It's set in Louisiana, and this is just 6 months into the war. A man named David Waters, at first, he welcomes Confederate soldiers to camp in his yard, freely shares his food with them. Then what happened?
Yes, and then things start to go badly. Some soldiers damaged some of his property. And David Waters, who is a working-class white man, he's an overseer, he said, if that happens again, I'm going to shoot somebody. And when it did happen again, he shot and killed a Confederate soldier. And the other men in that unit were so outraged that they completely destroyed his property. They tore down the house where he was living. They chopped up the trees. They completely obliterated all of his property holdings, which were not that extensive to begin with, and he had to flee for his life. And as you say, this happens in the fall of 1861. You know, this is early. And this is the sort of thing that happens over and over again at the ground level throughout the war, although I think that it tends to get worse and worse as time goes by. I think that the armies, both of them, develop a sense of entitlement. They use the phrase military necessity. You see that in the correspondence. Officers use it, men in the ranks. And they think that the army has the right to take whatever it needs from civilians. And that explains why by early 1865 you have so many white people literally running away when they see soldiers in a gray uniform coming close to where they live.
I'm speaking with Dr. Joan Cash, and she's a proud Atlanta native and associate professor of history at Ohio State University. We're talking about her book, War Stuff. What were the policies of the respective armies, the Union and Confederate armies, about taking things and pillaging, really, from civilians?
That's a great question. There are policies in place. They're not supposed to plunder or pillage. That's in the Articles of War. And they're also supposed to give out paperwork if they take if they take material resources from civilians, if they take all the cattle on somebody's farm, or they disassemble all the fences, or they take over a house and use it for a military hospital. They're supposed to give out paperwork that indicates what happened, when it happened, and the promise is that the civilian will be reimbursed at some point in the future. And that was left conveniently vague. Was that supposed to happen during the war, or was that supposed to happen after the war? That was never quite clear. But what I discovered is that sometimes the officers will follow procedure, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're in a hurry. Sometimes they think it's too much trouble. And you also have men in the ranks who decide they're going to freelance. They're going to go out at night if they're hungry and get something to eat. And if they confiscate all the poultry on a farm, they're not going to leave any paperwork. And sometimes civilians find out about this because they hear a strange noise out in the yard. You know, they'll hear a ruckus out in the yard, and when they go out there, they find there's a company of soldiers cleaning out the barn.
Even
their own. And that's one thing that actually surprised me is just how rapacious the armies were. And you might think, well, don't the armies have their own supply networks? In fact, they do. But those supply networks never work very efficiently. They don't have modern means of communication and transportation. The railroads break down. The wagons get lost. They don't always show up on time. Sometimes the quality of the food, for example, isn't very good. So soldiers will decide, you know, rather than eating these unpleasant rations that came in and smell like they're several months old, they're going to go out and get something fresh to eat. And soldiers repeatedly assert this in writing, that they have the right to do this, you know, that their well-being, their survival matters more than anything else.
Well, we're talking about a war that freed slaves. So there is an unfathomable mm-hmm. history of human suffering of enslaved people, and that has been deeply studied and recorded. But your research on noncombatants, yes. the white Southerners, also that as people, they were held hostage. They were sometimes beaten up. There were rapes. How? Mm-hmm. Was there any retribution or reckoning after the war for the atrocities really committed in some of these Southern communities?
Most of the time, there isn't. But I'm glad you brought up the issue of emancipation. There's been a lot of great scholarship by historians about that issue. And that's a wonderful contribution to our historical knowledge. But the irony is that there hasn't been as much scholarship to date about white civilians and their interactions with soldiers. And regarding your question, sometimes there are informal methods of retribution that take place. I found instances of civilians who shot and killed foraging soldiers, not just David Waters, but other people in other parts of the South. There also sometimes are verbal confrontations. I found a number of instances of women, white Southern women, who are very upset about what is happening and will launch into tirades at soldiers. You know, how can you do this? My children need that food. And the response usually comes back, military necessity.
Mm, the war is hell. We have
yes,
to wrap
it
but I have a question about the outcome of that. Did this struggle between civilians and soldiers have an impact on the outcome of the war itself?
Oh, yes, I think it did. I think it's one of the major reasons that the South lost the war. You know, the civilian population becomes more and more alienated. Even people who were initially pro-Confederate decide that all this suffering and deprivation just isn't worth it, and they withdraw their support. And it's unfortunate that the lost cause ideology that's created after the war very quickly and deliberately by the ex-Confederate leadership kind of obliterates this part of the war's history. You know, they create the fantasy that all white Southerners were pro-Confederate, and they also create the fantasy that if there was any pillaging or wrongdoing, it was the Yankee Army. Mm-hmm. It was never a Confederate a soldier who did such a thing. And of course, the person who gets demonized in all this is William T. Sherman. But I argue that Sherman is not unique. He is not unusual in the way that his soldiers took all the resources that they could take.
This happened across ranks, clearly, not just at the top, mm-hmm. not just at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely.
Well, you know, we have just 30 seconds left, so it's too
okay.
big a question for me to ask, but I'm wondering how that idea, this nostalgia, the idea of the noble battle for the Old South, how did that take hold among these people? I'm going to have to leave that to a hanging question and to readers of your book. Atlanta native Joan Cashin, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Joan Cashin's new book is called War Stuff, The Struggle for Human and Environmental Resources in the American Civil War. Now coming up, shake up your cocktail routine with a Georgia mixologist, a sweet addition to our main ingredient series. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is On Second Thought, back after a break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A new season of Minority Reports is currently airing on Vice.com. On the show, host Lee Adams explores communities of underrepresented people in unexpected places. The new season travels to the first ever Asian hip-hop festival and non-Korean K-pop groups. I spoke to Lee Adams during the show's first season about an episode that followed a white student at Morehouse and the reactions from his fellow students. I asked Adams why Morehouse, one of the nation's most distinguished HBCUs, is recruiting white students.
It comes down to a question of dollars. A lot of HBCUs are struggling, and they're turning to the recruitment of the non-traditional student, as they call them, as a means of financial sustainability. moving into the future.
So we're going to hear more about the sustainability of HBCUs, SUs in a moment. But you follow Tiago Rachelson. Now, he's a white freshman at Morehouse. Here he is telling you about why he applied.
Walking down Brown Street and having people acknowledging you and affirming you, that's something that they do here. And I love that part of the culture shock.
They're black students. They're black artists.
This place is sacred.
I think this is a safe space for black students.
And if we had white people just coming in here, I will feel disrespected.
You spent some time with Tiago. What was your impression of him? What motivated him to be the white guy at Morehouse?
That question, obviously, that was a question on everyone's mind when we first sat down with him. That was a question on my mind when I first spoke with him. And his answer was that, you know, he wanted something new and different, but that he also felt a calling to Morehouse because of the mission of the institution to produce leaders. What's interesting about that is Morehouse is known for producing the great black leaders of America and preparing those minds for entering a world that seeks to rob them of their dignity and their sense of self-worth kind of at every step. So it's interesting to hear a member of the majority feel this calling so deeply.
So here, let's hear, Tiago.
The most fundamental change, right, out of everything is turning me away from a self-absorbed experience. Decentralizing the attitude of whiteness, right? The attitude that I'm smarter, that I deserve this opportunity more than you, the attitude of supremacy.
So he sounds pretty self-aware. Do you get the sense that he feels like, you know, one of the nice white guys?
I think that his natural desire to take the lessons that he's learning and bring them back into the communities that he can navigate freely to hopefully initiate change is very admirable. And to hear such a young person acknowledge the privilege that he was born with and want to challenge that and use it for change, I think is good. He's definitely idealistic, to say the least.
Well, for you, so you heard some feedback from people at Morehouse saying, why are you focusing on the one white guy? You know, we've got a huge school here. What was your reason for that?
It's interesting because a lot of the mainstream media attention that is given to black schools often, well, actually, let me take a step back and just say that they don't really get the recognition that I think they deserve. And what I was concerned with doing, especially as a young black man whose family actually attended Morehouse, I didn't want to go there and champion the one white perspective that was present at the school. I wanted to allow them to drive their own narrative, but I felt that this was a way to at least cater to an audience that maybe is marginalized in the way that the mainstream media, you know, the way that the representation that they receive from the mainstream media.
So we do see Tiago playing video games, hanging out with other students, and the students from Morehouse seem to welcome him as a friend in person. Others caught wind of what you were doing, and they wanted to talk to you. Here's a little bit of that response.
I'm on the fence about it. What's taught here is not only how we fight for where we are, but how we fight for who we are outside of these gates.
If you grew up in an environment where you were mistreated and abused and just, you know, belittled by white people, you really don't want to see them when you come to a black space.
That bothers me because we have to provide a safe haven for our children.
So we hear a lot of that, this idea of the concept of Morehouse as a safe space, and historically it was. Do you, being there doing this documentary, get the sense that that still feels essential, critical, and necessary?
I do. And I think one of the key points of this documentary is to remind people that, you know, these schools were originally established and intended to cater to a black community that was excluded from predominantly white institutions around the country. And as we have seen hate emboldened in this country again, those safe spaces are more necessary now than ever before, especially as a young black man in America, when you're being disproportionately targeted by police in instances of violence, you want that physical safety, that emotional safety to be reacquainted with your blackness and your identity, and the freedom to be challenged intellectually by educators that look like you.
So if that boundary is broken down between having a safe space for African-American students and then inviting whites, other people, other minorities in order to make more money for Morehouse, what do you think the school and the students have to lose or to gain?
I think hopefully that hope from a financial standpoint, hopefully they're in a position to just have the money to maintain operations, because we've seen other HBCUs close down or lose their accreditation due to financial struggles. The things that they do have to worry about are when you look at schools like West Virginia State or Bluefield State, schools that are HBCUs but have a black population of less than 10% among their student body, that has to fundamentally shift the culture of the institution. And it compromises that culturally safe space that it was intended to be in the first place.
But there is the argument that in order for our culture to really confront racism, to really talk about race, we need people to step out of their comfort zones. And that may be Tiago and maybe African-American students at Morehouse. I mean, are HBCUs a safe place for that?
I think they're definitely a place that encourage that dialogue and conversation. And with Minority Reports, that was exactly the question that we wanted to ask, is how can we create this conversation around race in a way that's going to be beneficial and constructive for everyone? I think the thing that's important to remember about the black student who seeks out that four-year experience at an HBCU, every day they walk out of the house, they're navigating that same conversation. They're always sort of being tasked with being the cultural ambassador for Black America when you're one of few. And there are white spaces in society and there are black spaces in society. And something that is important is that this is a very, very brief four-year reprieve from that sort of confrontation with that conversation that you're tasked with every day as a black person in America.
That was Lee Adams, producer of Minority Reports. The second season of the show is currently airing on Vice.com. We generally land in the kitchen to talk with chefs for our main ingredient series. This time, we are saddling up to the bar. Jerry Slater is co-owner and mixologist-in-chief at the Expat in Athens. He mixed things up when we visited him at his restaurant by choosing sorghum as his main ingredient.
I'm Jerry Slater, proprietor of the Expat.
Now, I understand you're not just the proprietor here, but you're sort of the chief mixologist. Is that true, Jerry?
I have known to find my way around a cocktail shaker.
And why the Expat? Have you been been expelled from Atlanta?
it was self-exile. I had a restaurant in Atlanta for 6 years, in addition to helping open restaurants in the airport there. But my wife and I moved out east of there and really liked it, and had a more quiet style of living, and so we're only about 20 minutes from downtown Athens here.
All right, so sorghum, how do you use it?
A couple of different ways. In cocktails, we'll thin it down equal amounts with, like, we'll take hot water and make it into a syrup that, you know, we can move it a little better that way. So being a native sugar, it mixes well with, I think, other native products like bourbon. So for instance, when Chuck Reese of the Bitter Southerner wanted a Bitter Southerner number one cocktail, he asked me and I came up with one that's barrel strength whiskey, bourbon, a little bit of sorghum syrup, and barrel-aged bitters with a little bit of Fernet Branca. Have you had Fernet Branca before?
What is that?
Oh, it's super bitter. So it's an Amaro from Italy. And so when we stirred those four items together, it actually comes out looking a little muddy like sorghum. But it's a strong and powerful drink, and I think give you a little strength.
I'd love to know a little bit more of your philosophy of how you came to cocktails and how you understand ingredients like sorghum. What do you know about sorghum as far as historical use, for example?
Well, we take a lot of culinary cues from the kitchen, you know, when we're searching around for new ingredients to use behind the bar. For example, sorghum not only pops up in the simple syrup we use, it also pops up in the whiskey itself. Good friends of ours from Charleston make a sorghum whiskey. And to be whiskey, it has to have both the sugar and the grain in it, because bourbon or whiskey is grain-based. So they use the whole product. And it For instance, we put it in a Irish coffee, and that sort of malty characteristic of the sorghum whiskey plays really nice with a breakfast drink.
I like that you call Irish coffee a breakfast drink.
Stick around. There's a few more things. We can drink early.
This is the incredibly well-stocked bar. Sorghum whiskey. That's cool. What else have you got that will surprise and delight us?
We occasionally get some limited whiskeys. This one is literally called Baller. The thing behind that is it was made for a highball cocktail, which is just scotch and soda water, but this is a kind of a fancy American whiskey that's a single malt whiskey from California.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah. Let's see, what else do we have here? Local Atlanta rye from American Spirit Whiskey.
Mm-hmm. That's such a pretty bottle.
Beautiful.
Why sorghum? Like, why not use molasses? How did you discover this?
Looking for those native products, the same that we would go out and look for the best country ham or the best vegetable out there, who's growing what locally that may be odd or beautiful or wonderful that we can, you know, a heritage heirloom grain. I'll give you a good example of this. When we moved out here, we live in Morgan County, Georgia, my wife and I. Next to us is one plot of field. Normally it's cotton, but when we moved in, since they rotate the crops, it was a field of sorghum when we first moved into our home. And I said to the gentleman, I said, isn't that sorghum? You know, just a guy who was watching the cotton gin festival parade. And old farmer, and he said, yeah, but that's the milo. That's for the cattle. Not the sugars. And it was just sort of amazing, you know, that finding out that there's multiple types of sorghum out there. There's a low level one that's mostly for cattle, and then there's the taller grassier grain that's made for the sugar.
Jerry, I understand that you and your wife actually met in your cocktail bar.
We did. In this new era, I believe she wouldn't mind me telling you that she was on an internet date, and as ladies do in this era, she got there first to check out where the bathroom and the exits were, just in case, and we started talking before this gentleman arrived, and neither of us now remember what he looked like at all, but we hit it off pretty well, and she kept coming back, and The rest is history, I guess.
I said your wife, Krista is her name.
Yes.
Krista Slater. What did you make for her for a drink that first night?
Do you remember?
Eye contact. That's we made a lot of eye contact. I think somebody else was making the cocktails that night.
Some pretty bottles.
One of the things, whiskey from my old home state of West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
There's whiskey happening in probably all 50 states at this point.
What should no bar be without?
Bitters.
Do you make your own? Or?
We have in the past. Sometimes we'll leave it to the experts, especially opening a new bar. But we've done some fun stuff here already, just being 3 months old. We had a six-week aged Boulevardier, so a bourbon-based Negroni that we aged in this little barrel that mellowed everything out.
That little Campari barrel?
Yeah, yeah.
That's so cute.
So we made a big batch of it with Campari, sweet vermouth, and bourbon, and then poured it into the barrel and aged it for 6 weeks.
Well, tell me more about your sort of philosophy of the cocktail, because it's kind of in right now, right? Cocktails have come back around. What drew you?
I tell folks that America has created two great cultural things, jazz music and the cocktail, and they're both improvisational.
Improvisational, but you've just written a book about cocktails, so giving recipes. So where's there room to play?
The room to play, and it was really fun. It was the Southern Foodways Alliance Guide to Cocktails. And so while it's rooted in history, we organized, Sarah Kent Milam and I organized the book by what we think of as sort of Southern icons, But then within each of those chapters, you notice that people have taken that particular icon and sometimes, you know, like John Coltrane, stretch it out as far as you could go, you know, 45-minute live version, and it suddenly sounds like My Favorite Things again. So we got 20 bartenders from around the Southeast to contribute, and you can kind of see their original plays on those things.
What's the key to a great cocktail?
Balance. If we haven't done our work to balance that cocktail between acid or bitter or sweet, what have you, it's going to be out of tune.
That is Jerry Slater, co-owner and mixologist at the Expat in Athens. For more, you can check out his book, The Southern Foodways Alliance Guide to Cocktails. We'll be back after a short break with more of On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Trenton Tye is one of few remaining blacksmiths in Georgia and one of the judges on Discovery's Master of Arms. When not on TV, he works in the peanut industry near Albany. Tye spoke with On Second Thought producer LaRaven Taylor for our new Jobby Job series. That's conversations with people about how they make their living inside the industrial buildings, gleaming office towers, company trucks, vast farmlands, and often homes that fuel the region's economy.
Resharpening peanut blades isn't really something that you wake up in the morning and say, hey, I'm going to be a blacksmith, and the coolest thing I can do is sharpen peanut blades. My name is Trenton Tye. I'm a professional blacksmith in Southwest Georgia. I've been resharpening peanut blades for about 8 years now. Serving the peanut industry is kind of unique, especially to be a blacksmith in such an obscure thing in Southwest Georgia. You know, you have to fit the business to what's there. And one thing that was traditionally done was the remanufacture of these blades that the farmers used to harvest the peanut crop with. You know, we get into this thinking about doing the big gates and the railings and, you know, the high-end art. But the fact is, as a business, you do what the demand is in your local community, and we found this niche helping our farmers. The most challenging thing about the day is the work is hard. There's no two ways about it. I can't even say that's the most difficult thing. I can honestly say that even standing over a 2,300-degree fire is not the toughest part of the day. It's working with your farmers and getting to them and making the business function is the toughest part of it, just the ins and outs of the everyday business. What happens in the basic day is we make a bunch of phone calls in the morning and we try to coordinate our farmers because we can't wait for our farmers to bring the blades to us because that's like herding cats. Farmers are incredible people, but they are concerned with what's right in front of them, and being worried about having blades ready for a season that may be a couple months away just doesn't happen. So we have to gently massage that into things to be able to get with a farmer, pick the blades up, get them to the shop, do them, and then get them back out. So over the course of the day, it's one of those things. We're either going to pick the blades up, we are forging the blades, or we're taking them for delivery. You know, if you're interested in having blades done, you know, it's a matter of picking up the phone. We have to make it very easy. You know, our farmers have a lot to do with. So the fact is we need to be like ghosts. You farmers that we've done business with for years, they put their blades in a pile in the corner of the barn. We give them a phone call and say, hey, we're coming to get the blades. We grab the blades, and the next phone call that we make is, hey, we're making delivery. And it's that simple. And we have to make it that way because our farmers have so much to do over the course of the year. One of the biggest things is, you know, as they say, the literary capstone, and it's the same thing for blacksmiths. And I've been looking to write a book for a long time, and now I finally had the opportunity. So We have a basic blacksmithing book that really has a lot of stories about the local blacksmith, the man that taught me, Jay Reichert, which is an incredible fellow. He was the blacksmith in Andersonville. So having a chance to actually write a book and actually contribute to the craft is pretty important to us.
That is blacksmith Trenton Ty, who, in addition to serving South Georgia's peanut industry, stars on Master of Arms on the Discovery Channel. If you have a unique or interesting job that you're passionate about sharing, send an email to onsecondthought@gpb.org and just put jobby jobs in the subject line. Now to another fascinating job, location scout for FX's Atlanta. Donald Glover's hit show is nominated for a Screen Actors Guild, or SAG, award for outstanding performance by an ensemble in a comedy series. Jen Farris has highlighted some of Atlanta's most storied neighborhoods for the show, and she spoke with my colleague Kalina Buller, host of GPB's The Credits podcast. Kalina is a location scout herself, and Jen told her she thinks of her job as solving a puzzle.
People say, what did you like to do when you were five? I love putting puzzles together. That was like my thing. I could sit meticulously for 8 hours nonstop. Like, I just wanted to figure this thing out. Fast forward, I ended up going into locations in the film industry as early as maybe 2010.
Right.
And so to me, it's still puzzle. It's a big puzzle. It's crew sections of different departments. As I see it as one huge puzzle.
Right.
So every day when I work, if I'm on set, I still get to be a part of that puzzle. If I'm not on set, I'm scouting, which my part of the puzzle is really the most, I won't say the most important part, but it is the translation of those words visually. And I have to put that piece together so that the rest of the crews can do their job.
That's right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about scouting specifically.
Scouting is not just about taking photographs. As I tell people, location scouts are the liaison between the production and the community.
Right.
In short. But if you break it down even further, I am the translation of that screenwriter's vision. My job is to read those words on the paper and match them exactly to what my interpretation of that writer's thoughts. And years ago, I worked on an NBC series. It was a television series called Constantine. It came on NBC. And that was the first show I had ever worked on where they actually flew the writer in per episode. And it's happened since then. But that was the first time I actually would be in a van with the writer. And we would get to locations that I found. I loved research, so I would dig and dig until I found what I thought the match was. And I would have writers say, oh, my God, this is exactly what I saw when I wrote this. And I think that's probably the most flattering compliment a writer can tell a locations person is, this is what I saw in my mind when I wrote this scene. This building exactly matches. Sometimes architecturally it has to match. Mm-hmm. It has to match the era of time. I have to think about even the landscape. And early on when film came to Atlanta, the scripts I was getting were about beaches and deserts. And because they were coming from the West Coast writers and they were writing about beaches. And I'm like, oh, okay, we don't have beaches in Atlanta.
Right.
But maybe there's some lakes, maybe there's some, I don't know, you know, and try to find in texture that could maybe with the lighting change could look like a desert or, you know, but that's scouting is pretty much, it is that it is really, it's very important to find the realistic match to those words. And that's what a scout does.
That's fantastic. That's a great description of it. So you're being a native Atlantan, do you feel like, it sounds like that's really helped you in being able to translate what writers from all over the world envision.
It has been. When
you kind of have to be an expert at your locale.
You do. And even if you're, I think an advantage that I have being from Georgia is that I'm familiar with the terrain, but with Georgia changing, every time I turn around, there's a new building, there's a new something in construction. Mm-hmm. But I think there's still a benefit to being familiar with an area.
Right.
And if I'm not familiar with an area, I have an advantage of being able to pick up a phone because, oh, I used to go to that church. Let me call up Pastor Minnie because she knew my grandma. And you can get a lot of stuff done if you can pick up that phone.
Right.
I might not know, okay, dang, that whole neighborhood is completely different than it was when I grew up. But you know what? Miss Sarah still lives over there. Let me see if I can get in touch with her son, who can get me in touch with Miss Sarah, who can get me in that house, because I also have to scout on a timeline and a deadline. And just this past week, somebody had me scouting for something that they had been looking for I don't even know how many days, but I have become, I don't know why, this 911 scout. People will say, Jen, 911, we have to find XYZ. I don't know if it exists. I'm like, yeah, it exists. Because I grew up down the street from that, and I know where it is, and I can get it in there fast.
Right.
So it helps to be able to know just kind of where the bones lie. And if I don't know where the bones lie, I know somebody who knows where the bones lie who's from here. And if not, they can pick up the phone and call their people and call my people. And, you know, we can get this thing rolling, because time is of the essence, too. And sometimes a location could fall through and you need to be able to immediately replace that location with the same texture, energy and feel as the one that they have in their minds, I guess.
Yeah. So you mentioned when you were giving your descriptions that Georgia has pretty much changed. I mean,
it has changed. Atlanta, most specifically.
That's right.
Atlanta Metro has changed.
Yeah, it's becoming an international city.
Well, it always was an international city because of the transportation. We have a lot of import-exports pre-Civil War that made Atlanta what it is. But Atlanta it's so funny. Atlanta is very metropolitan. And you go 30 miles outside of Atlanta and you're in 1955. I mean, not even exaggerating.
You're right.
technology. The people in the town are slower, and that has a wonderful, it's not a bad thing, because I have worked on period pieces where we need to go back to 1955 and we need to go to a slower town with very little technology, and we need that story to be real. Mm-hmm. You know, when I worked on the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks, that story, I think most of the beginnings took place in the
40s. That's right.
So having a township that was literally built pre-1940 was believable for that story. They needed to find the texture, the architecture, the windows. I mean, I've worked on a movie. The art director, just sidebar, was from Europe. And she knew, because of her studies, that this window frame did not exist until 1960. And there were a few times where I'd say, now look, the window is not from the 40s. But she's like, we need it from the 40s. Okay, I guess I'm not finished yet. You know, she was not budging on architecturally. She needed it to be believable visually 100%. And that does exist in Georgia. If it's not a good location, you will know it when you get on set. Logistically, you'll know it.
Oh, the crew will let you know.
The crew will be pissed off. Like, who picked this stupid location? You can't even park your car. Like, it's important. Yes. So it's not just about the story, but being able for that crew to get to and from that piece also is just as important. The sound is important. The neighbors have to be even comfortable with you being there. Even if they're not comfortable, locations has to make them comfortable.
That's true.
Because they're going to make it miserable for the crew if they're not happy. Believe me, they're going to hate us if they're not happy about that location.
Speaking of which, I'm pretty sure that there were a lot of neighbors who were extremely happy about Atlanta season 2.
Yeah, they were.
Talk to me about that.
Well, one, they shot a lot of Atlanta season 2 in Northwest Atlanta, which is kind of in town, Vine City, English Ave, Ashview Heights, Cascade Heights. Like, a lot of the North and Southwest Atlanta neighborhoods got paid because they were chosen as locations. I see it as an absolute blessing whenever I scout in those communities, because a lot of them are not aware of how big this film thing is. Mm. They still, it's so funny. I get called, they're like, oh man, I hear film is blowing up. Where you been? It's blown up, boo. Like, this has already happened, but what it lets me know is they are not in it. They're not feeling, they're not realizing the exchange of funds mm-hmm. that goes into a location. Every time we pay a church, that's past the plate. You know how you pass a plate in church? Mm-hmm. I just sped up that process 10,000%. Mm-hmm. Now they don't have to pass that plate for those roles because this film crew just wrote a big check to them and saved them 10 years. I had a minister tell me that they had passed a plate on a roof for 10 years.
Wow.
And a film company came in 10 days and paid for that whole roof. And they were able to take all those past monies and put it towards something else. Like, I really love it. And the community, I've talked to kids while I was filming certain things. I come speak at schools. And these children are just eyes wide open. Like, the principal will say, I have never had a quieter assembly ever. Like, they're so interested in the process of making films. And they don't realize that their little selves could work on a set. You mm-hmm. know, like, they don't even know. So for me to scout Atlanta in Northwest Atlanta, in Southwest Atlanta, and of course they went in other areas, but it was just wonderful because now these children, I'm looking at it from a kid's perspective and even a community perspective. These neighbors are able to feed one more plate on that table, put one more, you know, plate on the table. Mm-hmm. They're able to send that child, get them a uniform for a KIPP Academy. You know, it makes a difference in the neighborhood. And I am very aggressive. Not that I don't want to scout anywhere else, but when it comes to Northwest and Southwest Atlanta, and especially where I grew up, Southwest Atlanta, it means something to me to know that I helped that father put one more meal on the table, to help that church get one more robe in the choir. You know, it's personal. It's personal. And I know that it can bless these families. So I am very excited when I hear shows like Atlanta coming into these neighborhoods because I know what it's going to do for that neighborhood.
That is location scout Jen Ferris speaking with Kalina Buller for GPB's The Credits podcast. The show could pick up its first ever SAG Award later this month. You can hear their conversation and more episodes on thecreditspodcast.com. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Tyler Morris is our engineer. Don Smith, Dean of Grammar. And Amy Kiley is senior producer. We always like to hear from you. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter at OSD Talk. You can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. Our theme music is from Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.